Welcome to episode 26 of A Legitimate Salvage, your episode-by-episode guide to The Expanse on Amazon Prime.
I'm Katie Burt.
I'm Warren Fry.
I'm Jen Burt.
And I'm Chip Sutterth, and we're here to talk about episode 8 of The Expanse, season 4, The One-Eyed Man. We're coming right off of an episode where every disaster in the book absolutely happened, and it's all about coping with the disasters in this episode.
Yes, it is. I do appreciate that there isn't, especially with the illest stuff, there isn't like a lot of, oh, things are, you know, descending into a worse situation. They're just kind of like, and things are bad. Holden is, you know, the only one who is really capable of doing things here. So, you know, as someone who is watching these episodes as we record the podcast, and has some time, therefore, between, like, you know, watching episode 7 and watching episode 8, I appreciated that, like, little mini time jump.
Yeah, that everybody's kind of, it doesn't get much worse in this episode.
No.
It
just kind of hovers around terrible.
Around terrible, never gets better. There's little hope that things are going to get better up until the point that there is. Let's go through the clever, it's not exactly a synopsis, it's more like a monologue, because so much stuff happens in this episode. But let's go through the overview for the benefit of the people who haven't recently watched The One-Eyed Man, and then let's dig into it.
First, we have Illis, where Holden is holding down the fort.
Oh, Katie.
Everyone else has gone blind from the green bugs eating their eyes. Honestly, the green murder slugs don't seem to be that much of a problem unless you are the random belter who wandered off. Sorry, dude. Tensions are high on the artifact, and Holden only has so many sedatives. Amos is losing it, the experience of being without sight having triggered some very serious-sounding trauma from his childhood. But Holden asks him to hold on, and he does, long enough for Okoye to crack the case. Holden's anti-cancer drugs are the key to saving everyone's sight. The scientist whips up some medicine, and voila, no more green eyes. Oh, but what's that I hear? The sound of Murtry scheming in the shadows? Some things never change.
Meanwhile, the crews of the Rossi and the Barba Piccola are ready to implement their plan to literally tug the barb to safety, and it works! And that's pretty much the whole storyline there. Meanwhile, Christian is dealing with the repercussions of the mission on the Pazuza. 12 Marines dead, along with all the belters who managed to get out a desperate transmission before the ship was destroyed. Was the mission for the Poles? General McCourt says so, and he tenders his resignation. Later, at a memorial for the Marines, Avra Sarala goes off script and delivers a seemingly heartfelt speech about the loss of her son and claims accountability for her role in the deaths of the Marines. Upon returning home, Arjun confronts her about the politicization of their son's death and her use of the fearful images from New Terra to gain the political upper hand.
Meanwhile, Fred Johnson arrives on Medina Station to a punch from Drummer and to reveal he leaked the intel about Marco to the UNNN. Well, he justifies it as a way to permanently control Medina Station. Drummer isn't interested in this type of politics and quits. Ashford asks her to be his XO on his mission to kill Marco, but Drummer declines. She's done with politics.
On Mars, Bobby's identity struggles continue. When SA takes a well-paying job for a group Bobby fears could involve moving weapons, she has a choice about what kind of Martian she wants to be, a rule follower who still believes in the collective dream of Mars, or someone who gets rich and doesn't worry about the consequences. Bobby's bed buddy votes for the former, taking a 10-month job to Europa and inviting Bobby along. Will she push aside her pride and fear and go with him? And finally, a wild Miller appears and changes appearance and screams.
And that was everything that happened in The One-Eyed Man.
Which is a fair bit.
All of the storylines. Like, we kept leaving behind, like, certain plot lines for a string of episodes. And now it's like, it's all happening all at once.
Yeah. So the Illis and Barba Piccola stories. These are disasters trending toward hope, as we sort of said at the top. And so we're recording this as the coronavirus stuff has gotten, you know, pretty darn serious. And I don't want to get super super deep and maudlin about the situation that we're all in. But when I started watching this thing, I was like, started rewatching it anyway. I was like, boy, this is really down and it's really getting me down and I don't like it. And I think I want to stop and I don't want to stop the podcast. And then there was hope, you know, the surprise that Holden's cancer meds are the secret to curing the blindness and the hard work of saving the barbapiccola works. And it's just, it just works. And, in the end, I kind of felt good about it, about watching this episode sort of at this time.
Can I just say,
wondering what you all thought?
I'd like to say that barbapiccola is the toughest name to say I've ever found in my life. It's ridiculously
so hard
difficult
to say.
And I keep thinking of Baba Papa, the old French cartoon. I don't know if ever you've seen, that might have been the thing that only showed up in Canada and France, but it's got nothing to do with this. It's just a very similar word. So I always want to say Baba Papa instead of barbapiccola, which I can't say.
It's hard, yeah. I feel like we had a lot of trouble last week, too.
I know.
You know, and when I was watching the storyline, the Barb storyline.
Thanks, Barb. Let's call it that.
I feel like normally that storyline might have annoyed me a little more because it is things happen, but there aren't really any character moments. It's just literally plot. Like, it's resolution from something that was really set up in the previous episode. But seeing them just like solve a problem with science, which they do on Illis as well, but I feel like, you know, the realization that Holden has like this very specific medical condition, it feels like that should have come up sooner. So that feels like less of like a feat of deductive reasoning and science. But yeah, I don't know. It's just nice to see people solve a problem, and for it to work out, because I would like that to happen in real life as well.
I would agree, yes.
Yes.
Very much so. It's fortunate, you know, we had the little hint at the beginning of the season, you know, when we had the reminder that Holden takes cancer drugs. Mm-hmm. So that was Chekhov's vial or whatever it is at the beginning when he's taking the injection, just the reminder. And then we don't think about it again until here. But, you know, it is kind of nice that there is this serendipitous thing and that there was an explanation that wasn't, oh, it's the protomolecule, it's Miller for Holden having been spared all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is a case where in a disaster situation, sometimes something works out, there's a discovery and everybody's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And that's nice and hopeful. And then with the Barb, it's physics.
Mm-hmm.
And the physics works and there's no artificial, oh my God, the gantry snapped. Well, you know, it's just, they did the research, they did the engineering, they just did it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they're rewarded for it, and we're rewarded for it.
And I kept being so afraid that cable was going to snap and, like, kill someone. So it was so nice that it didn't.
I know, I was like, can people get inside the ships, please?
And I also think, to the point of, like, I don't, so much of being in this, like, current moment, I keep trying to focus on, like, science, I guess, because so much of the news is a lot of fear, which is another part of this episode where they talk about, you know, Avasarala using fear for politics. But science, Okoye, like, comes up with a solution despite the fact that she's relying on Holden to, like, read her this information.
She's so smart.
She's so incredible. The fact that she, you know, people do come up with these solutions in, like, dire circumstances. And it's nice to be reminded that that can happen.
I have to say, one thing that I noticed is that with Holden, and he's got this anti-cancer thing, I'm like, so nobody else had had cancer?
That kind of drove me crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I actually thought that this was a thing that was maybe more common, just because, like, I don't know, there's a lot of radiation in space. I don't know why I thought this was a thing that, like,
more people.
I mean, they always have nuclear weapons. Like, there's nuclear weapons all over this.
Well, and just cancer is a thing that dinosaurs got. It's just when you get old enough, it's going to be coming for you. And these guys have managed to stop it, but that doesn't mean it's not going to show up, right? So you think more people would have like these ports, unless he got an outsized dose of radiation and you need this for it. I don't know. Who knows?
Which he did.
Yeah.
dinosaurs had cancer.
Yeah. I had this argument with somebody once about how she was saying that cancer has happened more and more now because of our modern ways. And I'm like, no, they've actually found dinosaurs with bone cancer.
I didn't know that.
Because it's a genetic mutation, right? And that happened then, too.
I do think it's interesting that Naomi makes the point, which, I don't know, almost, it feels like, I don't necessarily think that Naomi would, like, this feels a little out of character in some ways, when she says, like, something good came out of Eros, which is also, I don't know. Also, sometimes, first of all, it says a lot about how this show is always building on what's come before, you know. A lot of shows don't do that. It's like, you don't need to have watched like a few seasons ago. We've already forgotten what's happened. But also just that idea that, sometimes it takes a while for the silver lining to present itself.
Yeah.
The very thin silver lining on a very tragic situation.
I know.
Yeah, for sure. Of course, there's somebody in that group who isn't even thinking about silver linings. He's just thinking about the next step. Mercury is just it's really fascinating to me that, you know, he's completely physically helpless. He's depending on Holden to take him to the latrine. More on that later. And yet he's still pushing Holden. He's still saying that the Belters will never forgive him for having brought them to this place. As soon as his sight's restored and they're back on the surface, he's asking about his shuttle bomb.
Right, back to being a bastard.
Okay, as I was watching this, I was definitely yelling at them not to give him the cure. Like, they could give it to him eventually, right? But, like, maybe wait. I mean, and I know that probably wouldn't go down well with, like, his people, but
it wouldn't go down well with Holden.
I know, but, like, if Holden was more strategic, but Holden isn't strategic in that way.
No.
Which is, like, what makes him Holden. But, yeah.
It's like, oh, actually, we ran out. That was the last one, Mercury.
But you know Mercury wasn't going to win.
No, he's not going to be the last one.
No. And Holden is just so Holden in this episode, as he's been
really
all
is.
Along. He's like Sisyphus rolling the boulder up. He's like a martyr, you know. And Okoye says, of course, it's not on you, Holden. And Holden, of course, says it totally is.
Yeah.
It's always on him. He just takes that responsibility.
Yeah, and, like, I'm sure he hates this, because who wouldn't hate the situation? But I'm also like, does he kind of love it? I feel like this is his jam.
You know, I mean, people do have martyr complexes for reasons. You know, they get something out of being needed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are many points where Holden could have been like, you know what? I'm done. I'm not going on this mission to, like, Illis, for example. I'm just going to, like, keep hanging out this campfire at my family compound on Earth, you know? But he continually chooses to put himself in these situations.
I mean, he's leading everybody else on the planet to latrines. You know, that's his thing. He is now. He's really taking it out on those slugs. You know, he's got. There's a lot of catharsis involved in killing those slugs.
But so is Amos in a crazy slug killing frenzy.
Yeah, talk about character studies in our two lead characters on the ground there dealing with stress.
Oh, yeah.
I also love the moment between them when Holden is like, I can't lose you. They're both like, you don't, even though you know they care about one another and they consider each other family in some way, they're not the kinds of characters who are like that with each other. So I feel like the fact that Holden says that to Amos and is, I think, like, also, like, touching his face in this moment,
yep,
like,
yep.
It shows how dire things have become, that that's where Holden is and that's where Amos is, that moment even happens. But I loved it. Yeah.
And then that moment is kind of returned. I love it when Holden tells Amos that he's going to be able to see again. And then says, you know, I can finally say that I took you in a fight. And Amos's response is, you can say whatever you want.
Oh, yeah. Amos is like, I'm not about this toxic masculinity. He's like, thank you.
I think, like, they did a good job in the previous episode of already having Amos be pretty freaked out by being so trapped. And, you know, kind of fearing how this situation, before he even, like, starts to go blind, he's like, this is really bad. So that when he really kind of loses it here, yeah, it just feels all the more like it was leading. I was freaked out last episode by how freaked out he was. So when it got to this, of like, oh my goodness. It's scary to see him scared because.
Yeah, and knowing that he had, like, suffered something traumatic in, like, a basement, it already feels like, even, you know, before you lose your sight, that place has a very basement vibe. Yeah. So it makes sense that he would already be, and yeah, just the idea that he's trapped as well, already be, you know, suffering some of that, you know, PTSD, whatever you want to call it. And it says so much about Wes Chatham's performance that he's able to, like, start layering that on. So it does feel like you were saying, John, like a progression.
Yeah. I liked that moment between him and Chandra Way. That brief moment there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He has that line about like, she was like, we get to decide how we go out. And he says something about, that's all I ever wanted. Yeah. Oh man.
There are so many good lines in this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else on Illis before we move on to another sphere?
There's so. I mean, the fact that Amos like is looking after the urchin at the end of the episode is still pretty sweet as well. I'm still worried about that kid, but
I mean, hopefully
he's like mopping up his green like eye goo. Yeah.
Well, you know, hopefully after the I'm assuming they're gonna get off the planet. Who knows? But he can pass them off to some responsible adult.
A lifestyle better suited for urchins.
Urchins. Yeah.
And that's your urchin update.
Thank God. I don't think he appears again. Just a squirrel.
No!
Maybe.
I mean, I don't really know where that's going
to
go.
Like, yeah, I don't need him to become like a character.
A storyline where Amos is like, I guess we'll keep you on the Rossi.
It's like the Battlestar Galactica reboot.
Yeah.
They got rid of Boxy.
And Boxy's just a little jerk, too. I mean, he's got a point.
Yeah.
My parents are both dead. It's like, yeah. Well, all right.
No. The Expanse needs a 1979 Battlestar Galactica. They need the robot dog. They need the robot.
I was going to say, they need good old Daggett.
Yes. Always have.
But where will they find a chimpanzee? Come on, to be inside that thing.
Since those birds there's not a lack of animals on the show.
Yeah.
Well, let's leave Illis for a bit and maybe go visit Medina Station.
Fine.
It's been a long time since we've seen Fred Johnson.
Good old politics. And he has grown his hair out. And at first, I hate to say this, but I was like, who is that? And only the voice told me. because he's just got a way different haircut. And he seems just more, and it's probably intentional, more of a kind of a wild presence than he did before, where he was very buttoned down.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, he's just had it by now, you know?
It reminds me of when Naomi leaves the Rossi for a while and she gets more of a like belter haircut. It just feels like he's like, now that I've, even though he's still working with Earth, it does feel like he's going to this like more natural haircut as a like, I have more power. I don't have to fit into this. Yeah.
Also, we saw him previously in the season, but we have seen very little of him compared to before. So it's like you just kind of forget about him and his whole deal along with the other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and I find myself wondering about Anderson Dawes, too. You know, I mean, he and Dawes were such big figures on screen. And it's been so long since we've seen them. And when Fred comes back, I feel like all the energy in the room is with Ashford and Drummond.
Oh, yeah, totally. Is. Yeah.
Well,
even though I assume Fred Johnson has been off doing things, I also, because I have such loyalty to Ashford and Drummer, and it's them we've seen doing things, I'm just like, they're the ones who stayed. They're the ones who've been, like, getting stuff done. Because I think that either intentionally or not, like, having these two, like, much more public figures off away from, like, what feels like a lot of the, like, dirty work is maybe the, like, dirty is maybe the wrong adjective here, but just, like, day in, day out, like, decision-making of this ring space and Medina Station and how valuable it is to the Belter future and present. Yeah, like, just having them off be, I don't know, politicking or whatever, which, again, can be work, but, yeah, that punch from Drummer is an interesting, like, reintroduction for the character.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And that the choreography of Ashford greeting Johnson and then stepping aside and Drummer just letting Fred have it. I mean, that choreography is beautiful from a director standpoint and from a character standpoint. These two are such a team. Mm-hmm. I love them together.
I know.
And they were at first, so, like last season, right? So,
oh,
yeah. Yeah, and like Ashford, obviously, like you're saying, like, does greet Fred Johnson, like, obviously still has respect for him, and but then is also like, but yeah, Drummer really did make a great choice before, and she has some good points.
Yeah, he backs her on the decision not to space Marco, which he wasn't actually in favor of, but it's like, it's so cool to see, you know, at this point, he totally has her back. Which,
he does. And you know, it's personal loyalty. You know, he invites her to be his XO on the hunt for Inaro. But also, as he says, you know, his focus has gotten broader. He admitted earlier in the season how wrong he was about how to deal with the stuff in the ring gate at the end of season 3. But, you know, he sees a bigger picture now than he used to. And that scene on the gantry or whatever overlooking the cylinder is just so delightful. These are two characters who really get each other, and they didn't always.
I also love that he's got a broader view, but he's also gonna kill an MF-er. That's what he's gonna do.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. Also, I'm really worried about him. I'm just like, Oh, Marco seems like he is a pretty powerful and wily dude.
Well, the moment when she brings the alcohol onto the ship and then he's like, oh, you just keep it till I get back. I was like, oh,
no. Oh, no. Is there going to be a scene of her drinking it by herself?
I don't know. Well, she said she doesn't drink when she's sad, only when she's angry.
That's true. Well, she'll probably be
angry and sad if he dies, probably.
Which, that whole scene. She has so many good lines. Did you write them all down?
I did. I claimed last week that Amos is my favorite character ever, but then this episode I'm like, Drummer is so good.
So good are your favorite character?
Favorite character? I don't know. Yeah, sure.
It's a maelstrom.
There are just so many good characters. And just, like, the fact that, you know, they're filming that scene between the two of them in, like, wherever they are overlooking this giant ship.
I don't, it's nice to be reminded of like the massiveness of this colony ship.
And I'll never stop reminding you, stolen ship.
Yeah, I know. Whenever they bring up the Mormons, it's
Oh man, I wonder whatever happened to the Mormons. I don't actually want to necessarily know because it seems like we can't have.
Yeah, I wanted to come back.
I have an image of them in a suit, shaking their fist from Europa or wherever the hell they were.
They got colonized, man. They just got colonized.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is like, I don't know. I feel like Kara Gee is often the person who's talking about this in interviews as an indigenous woman. But just like she's that character, that drummer character is also often the one who's bringing up this colonialist like perspective. And She what she says is so beautiful in that scene, and so I feel like I just need to like read it back because I can't. It's so hard to articulate those things, or at least it's so hard for me to articulate those things. But I'm so invested in what in this question of what the future of the belt should look like, because it does feel like there's so much potential in this moment for them, and that has so many hopeful possibilities, but it also has a lot of scary ones, which Jeremy mentions when she talks about, the fear that what Marco Inaro thinks, Inaros thinks like the belt or future should look like, what could come true.
Yeah. She has, she's all along been saying that we should not become the Inners. And she's afraid that they're becoming the Inners. And, there are a fair number of data points here to support that. And she's just disillusioned, man. She's just disillusioned.
Yeah. Although the way that she, like, quits, like, how she is after that, especially with Ashford, it doesn't feel like she's defeated. I think she is disillusioned with this part of the Belter, I guess like organization or people or whatever, but it doesn't seem like she's lost hope, all hope in like the future for the, a future for the Belters that doesn't look like Marco Inaros's.
It feels like she still has a vision for what the belt could be versus like a Bobby who is like, doesn't have that vision anymore.
Yeah. So is there anything more to say about Ashford and Drummer and that Fred guy? Or
not
shall
yet.
We talk about
not
that other disillusioned yet. Character?
Oh, no. Or
see,
no.
I have to fulfill my role as...
he didn't come back?
Yeah.
I have to fulfill my role as the annoying guy who's seen it all, so... not as of yet.
Don't be a Cassandra, Warren. is that the right metaphor? I don't know. Anyway.
Yes, I think.
So Bobby Draper also disillusioned. And if Drummer is concerned about the belt not becoming what it could be or should be, Isai and Bobby have a conversation which really sort of brings her world sort of crashing down, that Mars may not be Mars anymore.
Yeah, that's rough.
I definitely, up until he makes the point about, like, why would you terraform this planet when there's a bunch of habitable planets out there, I did not think of that, you know?
I thought
society's breaking down for other reasons, but, like, yeah.
But that's a good thing to look at now, because the history is littered with people who just kept going with stuff when it didn't need to happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This is also the first time that, for me, Isai felt like a complicated character. Maybe not the first time, but the most effective time. I like what
they actually gave him a motivation.
Yeah, I mean... I understand where he's coming from. I also really hope Bobby makes a different choice.
Yeah, that's, I mean, when, I mean, Bobby's been living kind of the high life. And Thomas points out, you know, she's been, you know, the room service, the fancy hotel rooms, you know, everything's been great. And that's not, you know, that's not natural. That's not come that, not, that that's not something that comes with a consultant's salary. So he's seen what she was like before she started doing crimes. And now he sees what she's like now, and he calls her on the changes. And this is all happening at the same time that Esai's tried to have a come-to-Jesus conversation with her about what Mars has become. And then her nephew is like, hey, I got on the terraforming project.
I know. I kind of, like, I know he's just, like, a kid. But he's just like, oh, yeah, I never thanked you for, like, getting me out of that really bad situation. Like, yeah, you probably should have done that already. I don't know. It just seems like he's maybe, I don't know. He felt like a completely different character in some ways in that moment to me.
A little bit, yeah. He goes from hanging out with drug dealers to this. So, okay. Sure, you bet.
I was going to say, it turns out his, like, dabbling in the drug industry, like, maybe prepared him well for that, for his organic chemistry.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think they tried to make the point, you know, the ironic point or whatever, you know, Bobby saved him from a life of crime so she could go do a life of crime. Mm-hmm, you know, it's her Bobby's motivations at this point are just pretty much in a blender. She's throwing bottles at the wall because I don't know that she knows whether she really believes that the dream of Mars is dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting, the conversation as she has it with Esai versus her boyfriend person. What's his name?
I don't remember.
Thomas, boyfriend guy.
Thomas. Yeah. Thomas.
Side piece.
But also it's just like, it's interesting to see how many, I feel like when Bobby first got involved in this situation, it felt like she had very few choices and didn't, you know, she had a lot of bad choices and she maybe made the best one. I don't know. But now she has a lot more power. She presumably has some money. She is told by Esai that she doesn't have to, like, you know, do it. Maybe there would be some repercussions for that. But, you know, she has this other option to go with this dude who seems pretty cool. Yeah, so I feel like it might feel the same as when she first got involved, but it isn't the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mars government betrayed her. Now she's, I think she's, now it just sort of seems that she was still invested in the dream of Mars, if not the reality. And now she seems to be questioning the dream itself.
I feel like I found Bobby's storyline very relatable this season, which I think I've said before. I'm not doing any crimes, at least that I remember. But
that you remember?
Oh, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
I mean, I don't think I'm doing any crimes. But yeah, just that idea of, like, being told that there's, you know, if you follow certain rules and... Now just like
Jen's laughing at me.
Now just like maybe Bobby, the storyline will be like she gets like caught for all these crimes, and she's like, "Well, I don't remember committing these crimes." Yeah, I feel like she's. I think I'm just like my like millennial student deaded, you know, existence is like I'm projecting some things onto Bobby here, that you know, it's very interesting for me to do. Well, I'll let you know what choice I make, you guys.
Okay. please don't do more crimes.
please. We beg of you.
I'll consider it.
All right.
It.
Well, We'll see how this new extremely lucrative gig that Asai is throwing caution to the winds for will turn out for them all in the next couple of episodes. With only two episodes left on this season. And we wrap up, as we usually do, with Christian.
Ooh.
I mean, it's a great speech. It's a fantastic speech, which I think she actually means, too.
I do, too.
She says she means it, and I kind of believe her. I mean, she did deviate off the script that was right in front of her.
Yeah. And I
didn't feel calculated.
I think, yeah, you see her ignore the teleprompter. And I don't know. I think that Christian is very strategic and willing to do what it takes to kind of do what she thinks is best for Earth. But I don't think she's, like, cold-hearted. And I think it would take a real level of, like, to stand at a funeral and be that, like, bring up your own grief with her husband there. It just feels like, yeah. There's some calculated choices coming in here, but that was not one of them.
No, I think she just kind of said, okay, the hell with it, I'm doing this thing. That's how it felt on the show anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and
Go ahead.
Well, I think if it were just that, it would feel like maybe Arjun was overreacting. But definitely paired with what feels like the much more, like, grievous, I guess, offense is a strong word, but of releasing the new Terra footage. Yeah. Like, I don't know. I think, like, that specific charge of you're using fear and, like, panic to, you know, manipulate the public into making certain decisions. It maybe it was heavy-handed, but felt, you know, that felt like the most topical part of this episode to me. And maybe because of where we're at, not just, like, right in this moment, but in, you know, the last year, the last however many years. Yeah, I'm okay with somewhat heavy-handed because I feel like that point can maybe not be made enough right now.
I got the feeling, I don't know everything that happened behind the scenes as far as the recasting of Arjun, but I felt like this was a moment when the recasting really served the show, because I didn't think the previous actor playing Arjun could have pulled that scene off.
Oh, see? I do not like this guy. I don't know. And maybe it's just that he went from being very supportive, and this guy is like very much more pushing back at her, but that feels like, it almost feels like two different characters in some ways. But I'm not in love with this actor. I often don't think he feels like he is up to her level, which is hard.
Yeah, it's hard having her as a scene partner. But yeah, it's this is why I love having this podcast, because I do agree with, like, I have a similar perspective to Jen, where I feel like this actor maybe isn't able to pull off some of the material he's given. I felt that more in the last episode than I did in this episode. Or maybe I just kind of, like, gotten over it. But yeah, I don't know. Dissent.
So she did all the leaking, she did all the manipulating, or so Arjun claims, you know, even if it was sincere in the moment. He's basically almost like Holden in a way, just really stuck on doing things the right way. And one of the things that I thought didn't ring true as a line coming from Christian's mouth was her saying, "I only played the game the way you told me to."
Mm-hmm.
That's not the Christian Avrasarala I've known. She's had no patience for politics But she's played it really well all along. Otherwise, she wouldn't have gotten where she was. I mean, electoral politics is a completely different story, but still, she's savvier than that.
And she's always played her game, you know, even when she has made missteps. I would never feel like she would say, like, well, I was playing your game. It's like, it's always been her game. That's why she has so much trouble with her advisors.
Yeah.
She's always been in charge. There's no question of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like this as a storyline, though. And I think, yeah, I always love her stuff. And I thought this was a really strong episode. You know, in a lot of ways, like, they're really dragging out what is essentially like a, you know, election re-election storyline. And it's up against, like, obviously, like, things on Illis are much graver than things are for Christian. But mm-hmm. Christian's struggles in some ways feel just as intense and definitely not as serious, but the stakes feel very high, even though, you know, she's not being attacked by any green aliens.
No slugs in the room, just reporters. But
hey now, hey. Two of us are not.
Yeah, what?
But it almost feels like reality TV drama down on Earth compared to the stuff that's happening on Illis. I find myself a little more invested in what's going on in Bobby's world than in Christian's, just because I find Bobby more relatable. Christian is more fun to watch curse and flail and all that other stuff, but at the moment I'm finding more satisfaction from the Illis story and the Mars story.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I love a good political storyline like this. I mean, not that Bobby isn't political. I like watching politicians, fictional politicians, I guess. See,
I'm so bad.
More than
the average person. I like the politics of Phantom Menace. I'm that guy. I'm the one guy who's like, oh yes, tell me more.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So any final thoughts about the one-eyed man and how you're feeling about what's likely to come in the next two episodes, which will wrap up season four?
Without giving anything away, Illis is going to get bonkers. I just want to put that out there.
More bonkers?
More bonkers in different ways.
The part with when Miller shows up felt very like Twin Peaks to me. Maybe it's just the effect of like him changing appearance in a way that meant, I guess, does feel like things are going to get bonkers.
Trippy.
Well,
trippy.
Unlike Twin Peaks, they do explain why that's happening, so.
And we are grateful for that. I mean, for a show in which the laws of physics occasionally just go out the window because blue goo, this show does have a lot more internal logic, and I will take that any day.
Yes.
All right. So that wraps up The One-Eyed Man. We will be coming back next time to discuss Season 4, Episode 9, Saeculum? That sounds dirty.
It does sound dirty.
Please follow us. Please follow us at Legit Salvage on Twitter. We're on the Incomparable Network, so go to theincomparable.com/salvage to find all of our previous episodes. Thank you so much for joining us, and until then, all we did was buy ourselves more time.
And that's what we're going to keep on doing.